Hello, everyone. Today we're going to be discussing a thinker who has profoundly influenced me, namely James Burnham. James Burnham single-handedly wrecked my faith in free markets, wrecked my faith in liberalism, wrecked my faith in democracy when I read his book, The Machiavellians, many years ago. He also subsequently changed the course of my intellectual output, influencing two books of mine, namely The Defenders of Liberty, because if you know the Machiavellians, the subtitle is The Defenders of Liberty, as well as The Populist Delusion, which has a chapter on Burnham. In fact, also Applied Elite Theory, which is full of Burnham-y sort of insights. So, he really did have a big effect on me. However, because Burnham comes in a lineage and because he is continuing the work of what he calls the Machiavellians or of the elite theorists, for this video, I do recommend that if you haven't seen any of the previous videos in this Great Thinker series, there is a playlist here. And if you go down to the second week, watch the videos on Mosca, Pareto, and Robert Michels, because those three in particular, Burnham takes basically for granted that you understand them, that you've internalized their basic lessons. And Burnham is going to make a lot better sense if you understand what I mean by shorthand phrases like the organized minority, the iron law of oligarchy, circulation of elites, and so on and so forth. There's a whole kind of way of thinking and speaking that Burnham just takes for granted that those lectures, at the very least, will give you. Obviously, if you want more detail, you know, read these books by, you know, yours truly. All right. With all of that said, let us get on with Burnham. He's not actually there. There it is. There's James Burnham. Two things before I start as well. I'll remind people to pick up courses at the academic agency. I have many great courses here. Foundations of Politics has much of this stuff in much more detail than you find it elsewhere. Foundations of Economics, Trivium, Shakespeare, many other great courses. Buy it now. And the second thing I want to mention very quickly is that if you're not aware of James Burnham, he actually was somebody who troubled and you could say influenced George Orwell quite a lot. And it is said that the character O'Brien in George Orwell's 1984 is really Orwell's way of struggling with the core insights of James Burnham, because Burnham is one of the theorists of capital P power. O'Brien sees only power in 1984. This somewhat terrified Orwell, who wrote about Burnham. He's got an essay called Second Thoughts on James Burnham, which I directly engage with in aforementioned book, The Defenders of Liberty. So, if you're kind of vaguely familiar with Burnham, it'll probably be, you know, if you're not familiar with me already or some of my peers here on YouTube who have also talked about Burnham, chances are you'll have heard about him through George Orwell. Although he was later fairly well known in conservative circles, in National Review, and was given the Medal of Freedom, the Medal of Honor, whatever it's called, by Ronald Reagan. But anyway, let us get on now to Burnham's main ideas, which are chiefly found not in his book, The Machiavellians, which is really a kind of retread through the main ideas of elite theory, but in his follow-up to that book, The Managerial Revolution. In fact, I can't remember which one was written first. Maybe he wrote The Managerial Revolution first and then wrote The Machiavellians. Somebody will correct me in the comments. I can't quite remember now which way around he wrote them, but they were within a year of each other. Burnham's central thesis is that the great transformation of the 20th century was a managerial revolution. Capitalist society, the one we think of from the Victorian age with tycoons and the kind of fat, you know, the fat cats in their top hats and, you know, the millionaires and billionaires running things, organized society around private ownership and market exchange. But this older way of doing things gave way in the mid-20th century, according to Burnham, to a managerial society defined by large-scale administration, technical expertise, and bureaucratic control. So strictly speaking, according to Burnham, we have not been really a capitalistic society for quite a long time. When people, when Marxists are giving their kind of critique, it's an anachronism because they're talking about a world that no longer exists. What they should really be thinking about is the managerial society, the managerial revolution. One of the core insights of Burnham, and this is where you really have to understand elite theory. In elite theory, there is the organized minority, and they are the ones said to have functional control over society. They are the ruling class. Well, in classic Marxism, the ruling class is said to be the people who have the ownership of the quote-unquote means of production. And Burnham himself had been a Trotskyite. He had come from a Marxist background. But he said that this analysis can no longer serve because in so-called capitalist societies, there has been a severance of ownership and control. Severance of ownership and control. And the example I like to use of the old tycoon is somebody like Henry Ford. Henry Ford was an old-fashioned tycoon in the 19th century mold who was almost a complete dictator over his company, the Ford Motor Company, to the extent where he refused even to employ any accountants because he wouldn't trust them. What Henry Ford said went. His word was sovereign within the Ford Motor Company. He was very much like a little dictator. And obviously, Henry Ford, being a very rich fellow, had a lot of power and influence, especially in Detroit, a city that he can lay some just claim to having helped build, subsequently being destroyed, of course, many other areas. He got involved in politics, he got involved, he was an influential fellow because of the power that being the executive of the Ford Motor Company gave him. Okay, this power of Henry Ford's came from formal ownership. Now, most companies today do not work like Ford Motor Company under Henry Ford. There are layers of management and what they call governance and oversight provided by the fact that many companies today are not privately owned, but are in fact owned by shareholders. They have been floated on, they have gone public, quote unquote, and they've been floated on the stock exchange. And yes, you could get a majority shareholder, like an Elon Musk, say, or maybe members of the actual Ford family who are still, you know, own shares in the Ford Motor Company. But this is not the same thing as Henry Ford being the dictator of the Ford Motor Company when it was completely private. What has happened, according to James Burnham, is that the iron law of oligarchy, which is, you know, power accrues, the shorthand for that, Robert Michel said, was organization means oligarchy. Organization equals oligarchy. Well, the most organized power will accrue to those people. The most organized layer in the current structure are not the owners of capital. They are not even the shareholders themselves, who are often passive and who are often kind of led around by the nose by account managers of various sorts. In fact, the people who are sovereign are those managers of the shares. Now, to make this concrete, this is the difference between Elon Musk, who is the world's richest man and a multi-billionaire, but who, well, let's just say his various forays into politics have been nothing short of an embarrassment and of being completely ineffectual. And Larry Fink, the CEO of the massive company BlackRock, which has something like $1 trillion of assets under its management, who can pick up the phone at any time he wants and speak to the chairman of the Fed. So who is richer? Who has control of, who has ownership of more assets? Elon Musk, right? Elon Musk. But who functionally has more power? Who has functional control of many, many assets? Who does power accrue to? It's not Elon Musk, who is seen as a kind of a rakish renegade, something of a pain to the powers that be. Rather, it accrues to Larry Fink, who has functional control over huge swathes of the market through being the CEO of BlackRock. That is actual control. So what Burnham says is that once the managers recognizably come to take control over more and more assets through their management function, and as they control ever larger swathes of the government bureaucracy, internal bureaucratic functions of large organizations, let's say, for example, the HR function, very powerful internal organizational node within most companies today, they recognizably become a class, a ruling class in their own right, a class which has their own interests, a class which has their own tastes and styles, quite distinct from the old cigar-chomping, top hat-wearing tycoon of, 1,000 satirical cartoons and of the fevered imagination of leftists everywhere. Burnham is saying, actually, if you have a look at how things actually work, it's faceless bureaucrats everywhere that are running the show, from the guys who run the CIA and the FBI to the various people with clipboards standing behind the Prime Minister and the President, the various people with clipboards standing in boardrooms everywhere, the various people with clipboards allocating capital that they do not own, but that they functionally control through their management of aforementioned trillions of dollars of assets, a la BlackRock. What happens in this scenario is that the owners of the capital, the shareholders, are passive. They are as passive and feminine as the crowd in Gustave Le Bon, because a lot of the time they don't actually know where their money is being spent. They do not actually know, because it's being automated for them as a service by these various account managers by BlackRock. I can give you a good example. I found out a good while back that even my own pension, friends, is managed by BlackRock. And when I signed up to it, they didn't tell me that. Okay, but now somehow it's BlackRock that manages my pension. I have to say, BlackRock are doing a sterling job. Last time I looked at it, it was up 36% or something. Thank you, Larry Fink. You're making me a mint, son. Okay, but at the same time, I don't know what they're putting money into. I don't know how they've invested that money. Have they bought gold? I don't know. What stocks have they bought? I don't know. It's my money, but I don't know what they're doing with it. Okay, now I'm just one small guy, and the amount of money that I've got in my pension is peanuts, frankly, in the overall scheme of things. But even very, very rich people, very wealthy individuals, even whole companies, even massive multinational companies have their assets managed in this way, with the decisions being made in that way, where there is actually a severance between the person who owns it and the person making that decision. So this is something you need to grasp if you want to understand the managerial revolution. I feel, and I'm going to labor this point, because James Burnham is talked about a lot on the internet these days, partly through my efforts, but also partly because various other people have found Burnham interesting. I frequently find this particular idea that I'm spending quite a long time laboring is not adequately explained. It is not adequately explained a lot. And if you don't understand what the exact mechanism, the severance between ownership and control, you don't really have a hope in hell of understanding what, you know, the rest of the stuff that Burnham is saying here and why it is that the managerial class kind of develops a life of its own. One of the strange things that happens with managers is that their incentives and constraints are somewhat different from the entrepreneur or the old-fashioned capitalist tycoon. The old-fashioned, you know, the Henry Fords and the Elon Musks and so on were mainly concerned with making money, selling their car, you know, expanding their the bottom line, making the company run better. The manager does not have the same incentive or the same constraint. The manager, his incentive is to enlarge the remit of his own power, of his own portfolio, to make sure that that little clipboard that he's carrying gets more and more and more stuff attached to it, that his own little internal bureaucratic function expands. And so the manager is far from being in the business of solving problems, actually, paradoxically, ends up exaggerating problems if they fall under his purview. Now, let's make this a bit more concrete, shall we? I remember, and this is a story I've told many times, but it bears repeating. I remember being in a university meeting once upon a time, and you can imagine how popular yours truly was in these meetings, frequently being the only dissenting voice in the room. It could be 20 or 30 people in there. I'd be the only one who'd come at it with a different perspective, okay? Because everybody else was being passive. Everybody else was engaged in groupthink. Everybody else, you know, didn't want to be disagreeable. They just wanted to get out of the meeting. Frankly, I should have been the same looking back. Silly me, right? But I was under the kind of, misapprehension that the meeting was actually there to solve a problem. The meeting was not there to solve a problem. The meeting was there to greenlight something that had already been decided. Well, in this particular case, we were talking about the university welfare department. It was called the Hub or some, the Hive or something. There was some like internal function that was there to look after the well-being, the mental health and the well-being of the students. And the statistic that was brought up, the whole idea was, is that their budget was going to be expanded, that we were all just going to, you know, agree to expand the remit and the powers of the well-being center. Okay. And the statistic used to drive this home was that the average anxiety level of students was at 78%. That is 78% of all students had feelings of anxiety, i.e. there was some sort of mental health issue in almost 8 out of 10 cases. And I put my hand up and I said, excuse me, but, there's a different way of thinking about this. Surely the fact that it's 78% shows that the welfare well-being center has been failing in its basic remit. What other function gets to fail? I was like, show me the figures 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and 2 years ago. If that figure, right, has gone up over time, it shows that the well-being center is doing something wrong. It is there for the well-being of students, so surely that line should be going down, and then you can kind of reward that. But that was not the idea of the statistic, and that is not how people were thinking there. The idea is that this is such a crisis. Remember that word, crisis. There's a mental health crisis on campus that the well-being center desperately needs more budget. That was the way the meeting was designed. It was not designed for somebody like me to say, like, hold on a second, why are we rewarding failure? Thinking about it the wrong way, Dr. Parvini, okay? We need to give more money to the well-being center because there's a crisis. That is management speak 101. And the managerial state loves an invisible crisis, be it climate change, the war on terror, the war on drugs. Anyone you can care to name, because there's always separate, the war on poverty. The United States government has been waging the war on poverty since 1931. It's been waging the war on terror since the late 90s or early 2000s. It's been waging the war on drugs since the aforementioned Ronald Reagan. It's remarkable, really, how many of these invisible wars the managerial state has failed to fight. And yet the argument is never, you have failed to alleviate the drug problem, you have failed to alleviate terrorism, you have failed to do these things, therefore we're going to reduce the budget, or we're going to punish that department for not, you know, delivering on its ROI or its KPIs or whatever else, like, you know, any normal person would. Instead, they get more money. More money accrues to them. One of the banner cases of this in America is the elementary school system that they have over there. In fact, the same is true here, where areas that have had huge, and I mean huge amounts of federal and state level budget allocated to them, such that they have the highest per capita, per pupil spend, right? So imagine you've got a school with 100 kids in it. The dollar amount that each one of those kids is having spent on them is the highest ever in the world. And yet half the kids come out of that school not being able to read or write, or not being able to do even basic arithmetic. So what is the managerial state's solution? Well, obviously they need even more money. And this is the key difference between the way that the old-fashioned capitalist thinks, Henry Ford wouldn't have put up with any of this stuff, right? And the way that the manager thinks. It's the incentive of the manager. And once you see this logic, you'll start seeing it everywhere. This is, in a way, the genius of James Burnham, is because he was one of the first people to recognize the misalignment of the manager with the way things used to work. And usually, it's not a problem. It's usually their own power that they're after. It's more control. It's accruing more and more control to the management function, never actually sorting the problem out in the first place. And in fact, this recognition is the origin story of many, you know, so-called conservatives. Thomas Sowell being a very famous example. He started out working in the Department of Labor Statistics, I think it was, the Bureau for Labor Statistics. And he was in one of those meetings, just like I was, being foolish. He was actually trying to sort the issue out. He was thinking like a problem solver. He was thinking, oh, I'm here to do a job. Wrong way of thinking about it, Thomas. All of those people who engage in accruing more power to themselves by exacerbating the problem and trying to seek more budget. That's how Thomas Sowell became Thomas Sowell. Anyway, let's carry on, because we all of this across every field, across every function, across every aspect of life, whether it's government at the national level or the state level or the local level, whether it is business, as we've just been talking about, whether it's organizations like the army or the police, or the police force, every single one of them will have the kind of ruling layer replaced with the managerial class. Okay, probably a lot of squaddies watch this channel, and a lot of current and ex-police watch this channel, or have done in the past. And I have met people who are former police officers or are currently in the police, who say that the police is one of the absolute worst organizations for this now, for the gap between the rank and file and the management layer at the top. In fact, this is something that is exacerbated in pretty much every walk of life. It was terrible in academia. I remember the gap between the management layer and the actual academics. A modern day factory, for example. My dad was a engineer, senior engineer, plant engineer for many, many years. And he said there was always a huge gap between the boys on the floor, guys like him, he was an engineer. Obviously, he was pretty senior by the time he retired, but still, he had come up through an actual work, like through actual work, versus the boys who'd come in with their MBAs from wherever it was. Maybe they'd come from Washington or New York or Detroit. Maybe they'd come in from London. And they were always, it's always that same disjunction. Something that you see, a film that shows the basic split very clearly is Zulu. It's the Michael Caine character in Zulu, who's, read about it in books. And this is something that we touched on when we looked at Michael Oakeshott. If you go back to that lecture, between these different types of knowledge, the managerial class very much likes the kind of book smarts type person, the person who's kind of passed the right exam, who has the right qualification. And as society becomes more and more managerial, you see the demand for having the right paperwork, the right qualification over experience in all sorts of different areas of life that previously didn't have it. Okay, I just mentioned the police. It was never a requirement for police officers to have degrees. Now, if you want to be up in the upper echelons, you have to go, get some wank degree, right? Same is true of nursing now. Nursing, it now comes attached with, well, you must have been to university. And of course, you get a very different type of person, a recognizably different type of person who comes from formal education versus the practitioner who comes through the experience of the thing itself. Okay. Oakeshott called that, an authentic or practical experience versus the book smarts. The managerial revolution basically locks all of this in. It massively prioritizes the one type of knowledge and the one type of person above the other type of person across a whole range of different areas. The new ruling class has specialized knowledge, technical and managerial expertise as the primary credential of authority. It values the organizational position. Authority flows from one's role within large, complex institutions. It comes from the office, from the actual office itself, rather than from intangible things like experience, know-how, and various other things. And again, sorry for my literary references today, but if you've ever read that book of Mice and Men, do you remember the cowboys? There was that one cowboy who had the natural authority and the men respected him. He didn't have any spokes on his, he didn't have any kind of spokes on his boots, and he didn't necessarily have all the right gear and so on, but he carried the respect of the men. Everybody looked up to him. He was a natural leader. And then there was, I think his name was Slim. And then there was the son of the ranch owner or something, and his name was Curly. And he had all the right clothes, and he had the little spokes on his things, and he was a proper little dickhead. And the men didn't like him. The men respected Slim. They didn't like Curly, okay? But in the managerial kind of regime, it is the organizational position that means everything. Having the right lanyard, that's why they call them the lanyard class, having the right office, having the right set of authorities confers the authority rather than any other quality. And finally, system coordination, the capacity to direct, integrate, and manage large-scale operations. And all of this sees a displacement of the old bourgeoisie. The individual entrepreneur and the family capitalist are rendered structurally irrelevant under the managerial regime. It has no use for you, essentially. The decisive economic units become large bureaucratic organizations demanding professional management. The classic owner-operator declines through the sheer scale of modern economic life, quietly and without revolution. So sooner or later, everywhere, the old mom and pop store is replaced with the large multinational, and the Henry Ford is replaced with somebody with an MBA. Another classic, I mean, it's the replacement of Walt Disney, actual real life, the real Walt Disney himself, with Michael Eisner or somebody like this, like the CEO of Disney, as opposed to actual Walt Disney himself. And you can see the difference in character of the Henry Fords and the Walt Disneys. Okay, I'm not saying they were perfect men in any respect. I'm saying there's a qualitative difference between those, that stripe of person, the owner, entrepreneur, visionary, and the CEO. In many ways, it's the difference between Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and who was that guy? Eric Schmidt. Was it Eric Schmidt? Eric Schmidt was a man of a very different stripe from Page and Brin. It's the difference between, what's his name, the Apple guy, Steve Jobs, and Tim Cook. So obvious, the difference between the two. And we can give these examples because tech, small and big tech, are relatively recent industries. So they've gone through this managerial cycle a little bit later than things like the motor industry. But it's exactly the same principle. Occasionally you get a rebel like Elon Musk who tries to go the other way. Elon Musk is trying to, like, in some ways go back to the pre-managerial way of doing things. And, well, you can see how that's gone. Now, one of the most striking things, if you actually read The Managerial Revolution, he wrote this book in 1942, 43, I think it was, is that he says, look, societies with radically different official ideologies, as radically different as the Soviet Union under the Bolsheviks, Nazi Germany under the National Socialists and under Hitler, okay, Soviet Union under Stalin, and the USA under Frederick D. Roosevelt's New Deal. So New Deal USA. We're actually really the same system given different ideological stripes. All three of them were really centrally administered, elite-controlled, mass societies, managerial states, with an expanding administrative apparatus, central planning, and rule by organizational elites. The ideological label, whether in America it was, we're doing it for freedom and capitalism, ho, or we're doing it for the New Deal, or we're doing it for whatever, right? Whatever, the American dream. Whatever, BS, okay? Or in the Soviet Union, they were doing it for the, you know, the revolutionary struggle against capitalism, for the dictatorship of the proletariat. Or in Nazi Germany, whether they were doing it for, you know, the fatherland and the Reich and the Führer, whatever. Burnham is saying irrelevant. Look at the structure of the thing. Look at the structure of these three massive states and notice that they are basically the same. In one, they may be called Commissar. In one, they may be called Reichsführer or whatever else. And in another one, they might be called Manager. But it's the same function, and it is the same structural relationship. And if you go back in the history of this channel, I had a video called Another Way of Thinking About George Orwell's 1984, where the kind of big reveal is that George Orwell in 1984 wasn't talking about Nazi Germany, and he was not talking about the Soviet Union. He was talking about Britain itself in 1948, which had already become a managerial state, which is a kind of soft totalitarianism, or even in some cases you may find a hard totalitarianism, depending on how far you want to push it. What's interesting is that Burnham was pointing these things out exactly as the Second World War was going on. Ideology, whether it is the ideology of so-called National Socialists, the ideology of the Bolsheviks, or the ideology of, you know, the New Dealers or whoever else, this acts as a mask for what power does. What appears as a struggle between competing worldviews is frequently a contest over who will staff and direct the new organizational apparatus. The rhetoric invoking democracy, our democracy, or socialism, or national revival, or the people, or the free market of sovereign individuals, of sovereign consumers. All of this is gumph, basically, absolute rubbish that obscures rather than illuminates the real transfer of power. Burnham urges analysts to look past the language of political programs to the structural question: who gains control of the administrative machinery? Because the fact is that in each one of those avenues, you'll have a bureaucratic sort of individual, whether it's in the FDR's New Deal state, in Stalin's USSR, or in Hitler's Germany, there would have been somebody from a similar sort of function who power accrued to, the manager. And in all of these ways, all we were looking at is a war between different flavors of managerial regime. Burnham had no real faith in mass democracy or in liberalism. He says formal democracy often falls short. Large-scale modern organization requires hierarchy. It requires specialization, and it requires a continuity of control. These structural imperatives favor managerial elites, regardless of whether formal democratic procedures remain intact or not. Mass participation does not automatically translate into popular control over complex systems. The gap between the ballot box and the boardroom remains. And if you think about it, in a country like China, all of this is laid bare. China basically has no pretense that it's otherwise. Whereas in this country and in America, we like to pretend otherwise. There's this whole facade called democracy. But when you start to have a look at the things that the state really cares about, what does the state really care about? It cares about foreign policy. It cares about war. It cares about long-term planning of, for example, the State Department. And on the face of it, the change from Barack Obama to Donald Trump to Joe Biden back to Donald Trump was absolutely earth-shattering. It was a huge shift. Did it change anything? Did it change the ruling class? Did it change the direction of foreign policy? No. No, it didn't. Because, according to Burnham, all of that stuff is flim-flam. It is the froth on the top of the coffee. Because the real state, when people today talk about the so-called deep state, this is what they're talking about, is run by people you've never heard of. It's run by managers. Now, I just mentioned war. War and crises of various kinds act as accelerators. Modern war and economic crisis are genuine engines of managerial consolidation. mobilizing national resources, directing industrial production, and coordinating large populations on short time scales demands exactly the kind of centralized administrative authority that expands the scope and legitimacy of managerial elites. And again, I reference this book a lot, but the reason I mention it so often is because it is onto something. Let's see if I can find it today. I can never find this book. It is, yeah, here it is. It's Robert Higgs, Crisis and Leviathan. He wrote this book, obviously, after James Burnham, but Crisis and Leviathan has it in one title. Every time there's a crisis, every time there's a war, the net result is that the managerial state expands its own remit of power, expands its controls, gets larger. Think about the impact of the First World War. We talked about the old capitalist tycoon and laissez-faire and classical liberalism. Classical liberalism died in 1913. Why? Because the war effort of the Great War, World War I, in both America and in Britain and in France and in Germany required such coordination, such central planning, a war economy, that it killed the idea of laissez-faire dead, because the powers that accrued to the state at that time were never given back. Never. It held on to them for the rest of time till now. Eventually it will lose them when all this collapses, but you know, that probably was not going to happen in our lifetimes. And then as big as that state grab was, then we had the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression, another crisis, a massive financial crisis. Powers accrued to the United States government, to the Federal Reserve, to the Bank of England, and to the British government during that time that were never given back. Never, never. The New Deal was here to stay forever. The welfare state was here to stay forever. And so it was with World War II, which basically consolidated all those gains that were made in World War I and expanded them. And then when all those men came back, the ones who did, the ones who weren't tragically killed, when they came back, then, well, it's like, well, the state is now so big, kind of has to look after these guys as well. Needs to lay on hospitals, needs to lay on welfare, or if they fall on hard times. From cradle to the grave. That was Clement Attlee in the aftermath of World War II. And in America, because of its kind of frontier spirit, it took a little bit longer, but they got there as well. The Great Society of LBJ, sort of around the corner. And many of those things that were accrued under FDR were never undone either. So Leviathan expands through crisis. The state power does not, once it's got something, it doesn't want to let it go. And all of these powers are accruing to the managerial class, to the managers. They are the ones who were empowered by all of these things that I've just talked about. And the process has only continued and accelerated since Burnham wrote. So, therefore, if this is the name of the game, what then of politics? What is politics at the end of the day? In the managerial age, the central political conflict shift in character. In classical politics, it was the owners versus the workers, a conflict structured by property and class in the old-fashioned Marxist sense. Whereas in the managerial regime, we get competing managerial factions contesting control of the state, of corporations, of media, of increasingly NGOs and other large organizations. And one of my favorite little pieces by Burnham is this little-known essay of his called Managing the Managers, where he says, look, in such a scenario, you cannot hope, basically, to overthrow the managers. There's going to be some flavor of manager in charge. And it doesn't matter what you call them. You could call them socialists. You could call them capitalists. You could call them whateverist. But there's going to be a flavor of manager in charge. This is one of the problems of mass and scale. It comes about as a necessity because society is so large now that it takes all of that coordination, takes all of that large-scale coordination in either management function. So you can't do away with the managers. The best that you can hope for is a situation where the managers are constantly fighting other rival managers to the extent where they have to manage the managers. And that's the name of this paper. It's called Managing the Managers. And for Burnham, you could say this is quite bleak, but the only scope for increased freedom for little old us, for the ruled, the normal little men and women, was that the elites are basically stuck fighting each other, trying to manage each other, and therefore we slip through the cracks, or we can use that situation where they're all fighting over there. We can kind of navigate that and find a little bit of increased freedom for ourselves in the little fissures and cracks. Because the alternative, which is any one of these groups predominating to the point where they have 100% control, is kind of intolerable. It becomes oppressive. It becomes, you know, there's no freedom. It becomes like Stalin's Russia or like, you know, your image of Nazi Germany or whatever else. So this is what Burnham ultimately said is the best case scenario, the managers all managing each other, the managing of the managers. This is a realistic theory of power in which the elites are permanent. Every complex organized society generates and sustains ruling elites. This is a structural fact and not a pathology. You just can't get away from this triangle on the front of this book. You can try as you might. You can try to twist it this way or that way, but the fact is the triangle stays that shape and there's a small group control a much larger group. And this is a structural fact. There's just no way around it. Secondly, the question is which elite? The significant historical transformation is the replacement of one elite type by another elite type. The bourgeois elite supplanted by the managerial elite. And third, we must analyze power, not rhetoric. Burnham insists on examining the actual distribution of power, stripping away the comforting myths that obscure how societies are truly governed. Ignore BS, 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 therefore we rule, and look at what is actually happening. And you will find there is not so much difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, or between Democrat and Republican, or between your favorite woke corporate manager and your favorite quote unquote conservative manager. Right? You understand what I'm saying? They're just flavors of the same thing. The same ruling system. Now, there's quite a bit more to get into. Burnham wrote quite a number of books in which he expanded on these ideas. I've just kind of scratched the surface here. One of the things I didn't get into over the course of this is how change happens, according to Burnham. And this is one of the more depressing bits, really, in the populist delusion. It's on this page here, where you can see it's on page 103, where Burnham outlines six different things that need to happen for any real kind of circulation of elites to take place. And what's remarkable about those six things is that five and a half out of the six of them basically are up to the existing elite and their current will. I wrote, this is me. It is notable that of these six criteria, only one considers the discontent of the masses. And even then, it is only half of the point. Or in other words, five and a half out of the six criteria concern the elites. that is the current incumbent elites, the ones currently in charge. When considering our current situation under managerial dominance, we might say that the current elite do adjust to new technologies, still have an insatiable appetite to rule, do not question their own legitimacy, and believe their own myths. So far, so good. So there we go. And I continue, but the fact is that people imagine, people, even people immersed in this sort of material, don't truly understand how little is in the purview of the mass, who truly are a passive, feminine, and disorganized mass, okay, of people each doing their own thing, as against the organized elite. One of the reasons they don't quite understand how little power the disorganized mass have, or even the organized counter-elite, okay, you could organize yourself into a counter-elite, right? But let's just pretend that five of you meet up. We're going to conspire around a table, going to start making plans, going to start becoming organized. What's the immediate problem? The ruling class has an absolute advantage in many, many, many areas. It has an absolute advantage in communication. It has an absolute advantage in knowledge. And when I say knowledge, it has all the data. Right? It kind of knows things that you don't know. It has an absolute advantage in being able to coordinate large groups of people immediately. It has an absolute advantage in its functional power. That is, which areas of life, which levers it can pull. It has an absolute advantage in its physical force, namely its command of the army and of the police. So what Burnham is saying is that, look, as long as the ruling class in a system stays united, as long as they still want to rule, as still as they believe that they are in the right, as still as they believe in their own crap, it's going to be very hard to dislodge them. Very hard indeed. It is only when they get to draw on some old D&D games, morale failure, running, or when significant portions of the elite class themselves in key positions of power become sufficiently discontent and unhappy with the state of things that they no longer follow orders or they start going their own way. It is only under those sorts of conditions that a ruling class falls. People far too easily overrate the fragility of any given regime. They overrate the fragility and they underrate the capacities of, for example, the managerial state to bounce back, to change narratives, to pull this lever on that lever, to create crises where there were none, to flip scripts, right? Oh, now there's a war. Now it's COVID-19. Now it's Ukraine. Now it's, now it's Keir Starmer. Now it's Andy Burnham. Now it's some other dipshit. Now it's Joe Biden. Oh, now it's Donald Trump. Well, all nonsense, all crap. If what you really wanted to do was an overthrow of this regime, and yet look at how effective all of those things are at consolidating the permanent ruling class. Anyway, this week I'm talking about the problems of mass and scale. We started with James Burnham, although I feel that we could easily have another second lecture on Burnham because there's so much to cover. But instead of covering Burnham again, tomorrow I'm going to be looking at Jacques Ellul, very interesting thinker, who thought deeply about technology and the problems of mass and scale. Join me then, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, buy Populist Illusion, Applied Elite Theory, and all my other books. But most importantly of all, get out. Right, about that thing we were discussing. Okay.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.